Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Glad Tidings, the Athletic's Everton Football Club podcast. The lads are all back together again. It's me, Greg O'Keefe, and I'm joined by my colleague and fellow Everton correspondent for The Athletic, Paddy Boyland. How are you getting on, Pad?
Good. I'm all right, yeah. I was just, after last time we were obviously joking about going to Burnley and how cold it was going to be north of the wall. I've finally, I think, thawed out. We're on the Thursday after that game and I've just about thawed out from the cold temperatures there. Just about thawed out as well from what we had to witness in that game, which I'm sure we'll get on to in a bit. But no, I'm okay. I'm probably about as good as could be in the circumstances. How about you?
Not bad. Can I borrow your deer skin suit and torch and sword for Goodison on a Saturday night? Because as much as Burnley is ice station zero, Goodison can mix it with any of them when it comes to being an absolute ice pit, and I suspect it's going to be just that tomorrow. So
fans back though, at least, eh?
Fans really back exciting to have some fans back. I'm sure that'll raise the temperature a bit, yeah, definitely. Right, plenty to whiz through, aside from the temperature of Paddy and I in today's podcast, including that Burnley game, which we enjoyed and then endured again, in terms of how we saw things change tactically. Then we'll talk about a really interesting piece that is going to be on the site very soon that Paddy's done with Tom Wervell, one of our stat experts, talking about James Rodriguez and what I'm sure Paddy will agree is some rather unfair criticism in certain quarters for him. We'll look at the Chelsea game Saturday night, Goodison Park, under the lights, and talk about the piece that I've done as well on the site this week about Dennis the Strack-Willersey. So before we get into that, let me remind you that right now, if you subscribe to Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any footy fan this Christmas. Enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. Wave goodbye to 2020. Yes. Get out, go, and say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage for the whole year. It really is the perfect present for yourself and someone else. And just go to theathletic.com/EvertonPod. That's theathletic.com/EvertonPod and sign up. So, to Turf Moor. Burnley, a very icy Paddy, and not much to warm the heart, other perhaps than something reverting, you know, not through any positive reasons, but reverting to four at the back. What did you make of it, mate?
Yeah, kind of on that last point, bit more kind of luck than judgment, I felt, in the way things transpired. Very rare that an injury, particularly an injury to kind of a seasoned squad member, actually helps the side improve and pick up. But that's exactly what happened, in my opinion. Fabian Delph obviously went off injured around the half an hour mark and was replaced by Andre Gomes. I was kind of scratching my head as that was happening. I was like, is Andre Gomes really going to play left wing back? Doesn't strike me as his role. But he didn't. He kind of went into midfield and we saw a reversion to that 4-3-3 that served Everton pretty well, let's be honest, at the start of the season. They just looked, from that point on, from 30 minutes on, they just looked much, much better. And obviously it was far from perfect. They didn't win the game. They recovered from losing a goal early on. Really sloppy mistake from Alan. Robbie Brady kind of driving home from the edge of the box, and they recovered to get a point. Pushed, looking for that extra goal, that winner. And nearly got it, very, very nearly got it. But they just came up short. I think all we can say is that even after the game, Ancelotti and Michael Keane, who were on media duties, they both said that the squad is just more comfortable with four at the back. In my head, then I was kind of taking that a step on and thinking, why is it taking so long to realise this? Why have we moved away so much from the success of the formation that brought success in the early part of the season? Doucouré and Allen just looked better with an extra man alongside them. Richarlison started getting the ball a little bit quicker, helped by the fact that there's another midfielder there in Gomez to shuttle the ball on. I thought Alex Iwobi and Ben Godfrey, who became makeshift fullbacks rather than wingbacks, I thought they both did admirably, really, in the circumstances, and helped shut Burnley out. And on another day, Everton would have come away with 3 points. They created more than enough chances to do so. Sigurdsson missing that one and various other players. So, yeah, it's a tough one at the moment. I think is almost, in some cases, whenever you put Twitter on after an Everton game at the moment, whenever they don't win, it almost feels like Groundhog Day. But maybe there are a few small shoots of recovery in the way that the system change helped bring more out of the players. Certain players looked better. People like Gomez, he looked better. And on another day, they could have won the game. So yeah, there is that, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it is clinging to slim solace, isn't it? But I do think I just prefer to see Everton at the moment with the back four, with the extra body midfield. And, you know, as much as Andre Gomez hasn't been anywhere near at the levels that are required this season, I think he was better on Saturday. Frustrating. I think with Iwobi, you know, there's been a lot of bright points lately, but I just felt that, and we've chatted about it internally in our place, haven't we, with one of our colleagues about it this week. And I just felt that there was so many, he just lacks consistency with his final ball. There were three, maybe four crossing opportunities towards the end. And I think a couple of them just, you know, completely missed the mark. One went into the stands, then the other was overhit. And it was just, I'm not picking on him, he wasn't by any means the only one. You know, Gylfi Sigurdsson probably should have put that away, albeit a good save from Nick Pope. But when you've got Dominic Calvert-Lewin and you've got players like Charlton busting into the box, the quality of the delivery from Iwobi was poor, I felt, and it was disappointing with the games that we've got to come away from there with just the point.
It was, and I think this was a big opportunity, really, for Everton to get back on track, particularly against the Burnley side that started the day. I think it was in 19th.
Yeah.
Gifting them a goal early on and helping them.
That's it.
I think not only did we gift them the goal, but because of that goal, you could see them visibly grow in confidence. And the talk in the press box at Turf Moor was that, for those that watch Burnley week in, week out, that was one of their best performances of the season, if not the best. Now, that's telling, that's striking. And it says something about where Everton are at this moment in time. I just feel with Iwobi, and maybe I had a lot of people say how wasteful he was and comment on that after the game. And I wonder if there's a slight distinction to be made here between the perspective you get watching the game at home in front of the telly and the perspective you see at the match. Because I was speaking to Adam Jones from the Liverpool Echo and a few other reporters that cover Everton after the game, and we were all saying, Alex Iwobi looked all right, he did okay. And the feedback from everybody that watched on TV has been quite different. I've been struck by that. And I guess what the only thing I can point to here is that, yes, he was wasteful at times in the second half, particularly as the game progressed past kind of 60 minutes. There were three or four opportunities to cross the ball, and he wasn't even close to picking out a man. There were other times when he was good. First half cross for Calvert-Lewin for a save by Pope. One in the second half that somebody I think should have got on the end of as well. But on the whole, let's say his delivery was a little bit erratic. What I could see from my vantage point, which is kind of a bird's eye, you're really high up in the press box, in the stands at Turf Moor. But what I could see from my position was the extent to which Everton's right back in particular effectively has the whole of a flank to cover. Because of where James is, on the pitch. And I think that's put in even more stark relief by just how high up you are and just how much of a bird's eye view it is. You almost see this guy, and it must be quite a daunting task, actually, with like 100 metres or so of space in which to manoeuvre and manage and run. And Iwobi was often at a numerical advantage defensively. He was the one, I think he was more or less the one tasked with picking up the ball and driving forward and getting Everton going through the thirds, particularly when the passing was sloppy, as it was early doors. And there were so many good, promising runs from him where he just put his head down, he just made his way past two or three, drew a foul or created something. Like, let's say, for example, in the first half with that chance for Calvert-Lewin, then I think I am probably a little bit more lenient with regards to his performance there. Even at right back, I thought he did all right.
I think that's fair enough. I think it's a good point about the difference between perspective of where you watch it as well. I don't think it's an easy gig for him at all. Let's not forget, he's never been really a fullback, has he, or a wingback?
No, he's not, and that's the other thing, I guess, that we should probably throw into the equation. First of all, has to play as a wingback, and then secondly, as a fullback. And I think as a fullback, you've got even more defensive responsibility. But Burnley are never the side. If there's one game you can play that way, Burnley are never a side, I don't think, that are going to massively stretch you in behind. The wingers aren't going to always double up and ask you loads of questions. But I thought most of his defensive work, he was all right, save for one or two moments. And most of his attacking work, he did pretty well, both driving with the ball and creating chances. So, yeah, I guess I was prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt. I was prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt in those circumstances. Same with Ben Godfrey on the other side, who didn't have much of a role going forward, but I thought he was solid enough. Mm. Again, being asked to play in a different position. And yeah, I just think I've got to the point where I'm just looking for any little kind of positive nugget that I can find anywhere here. Those two were all right. Calvert-Lewin, obviously, nabbed his goal again. The kind of goal that we've seen now three or four times this season.
Yeah, it's quite common sight, that goal, isn't it?
It is. It's basically the goal that scored against Fulham. Off the top of my head, where Richarlison gets to the byline, cuts it back, and Calvert-Lewin slides and puts it in. We've seen it a number of times, and those two have got a really good relationship when they get in those areas. So I think we've just got to see more of it from an Everton perspective. They've got to be more assured in possession, better with their final delivery, service, particularly Richarlison, a little bit more. Because at times I thought he was just a little bit isolated out on that left flank. But the one big takeaway, and I think we've both said this, is just the extent to which they improved with four at the back, with everybody being more comfortable and knowing their roles. I just think if there's one message for Ancelotti to take here, it's that those players are better suited to that style at the moment. They're more used to it. And when you've got a tricky run of fixtures coming up against Chelsea and Leicester and Arsenal and Manchester City, Sheffield United, various other sides, you're going to need to rely on those things because the margins are going to be so tight if you want to get anything in your favour.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll come on to Chelsea in a minute, but we will pick up on a theme that you mentioned there. James or James Rodriguez, there's a two sort of dual kind of warring observations about Rodriguez. It's people who have begun to doubt his efficacy as the sort of days have grown shorter and the temperature's dropped and Everton's form has completely faltered. Then there's the sort of rent-a-gobs like Gabby Abong-Lahore. And then there's Evertonians who, for him he can do no wrong. And that, as usual, I think the truth's not quite in the middle because it's not that close to Abong-Lahore, in my opinion. But I still think most of the good stuff comes through. That's my opinion. I do know that you've had a real, like I said at the top of the show, you've had a look into it with Tom. What has he been unfairly maligned? What are the stats telling us?
I think that people look at things like the fact he's not set up a goal or scored a goal since the Merseyside derby a couple of months ago. And I think they used that together with Everton's form as a stick with which to beat him. The only problem is when you're using things like assist numbers, what you're not taking into account is how many chances he's actually creating, how good the opportunities are, and whether, for example, somebody is squandering those chances. So take the Burnley game, for example. Late on in that game, we've already mentioned Sigurdsson has a golden opportunity. I think he should probably score, truth be told. Place it either side of Nick Pope and it's a goal. it's in the back of the net, and Everton win that game 2-1. No other player on the pitch sees that pass. That's my opinion. No other player sees that pass. No other player executes it like Rodriguez.
Well, yeah, that's the point as well, isn't it? Yeah,
which is the point. So on another day, that's his assist. And because Sigurdsson hasn't scored it, that run kind of ticks on now. And I just think that's a little bit unfair. And that's not an isolated instance. You look at the game against Leeds. Mason Holgate has a good chance from a Rodriguez free kick. Richarlison scores, but it's disallowed from a Rodriguez corner. Rodriguez has the ball in the net himself. Marginally offside, but he is offside. And I just think those things have not really gone in his favour recently. But he's still actually, in terms of like the bare underlying numbers, he's still actually performing at much the same rate. If there was a drop-off, and I can chart one, then the drop-off, statistically at least, was after the Merseyside derby in the games against Southampton and Manchester United, where, do you remember, he picked up the injury against Liverpool. The hematoma, as Ancelotti keeps calling it after that late tackle from Virgil van Dijk. wasn't really 100% fit for Southampton. And I don't think he was 100% fit for the Manchester United game either. And kind of struggled in both of those matches. And his numbers there did fall off a cliff. Objectively, that's what you can say. Stuff over it being too cold for him and his body language and all that kind of stuff. I don't really read much into them. Burnley's cold, but I tell you what, has anybody ever been to Munich in December or January, where he obviously played at Bayern Munich? I used to live in Madrid, so I know how cold Madrid can be in the winter as well. And obviously he played for Real Madrid. So stuff like that, I think that they're just kind of really basic, unnecessary points. And almost kind of cliches and stereotypes that we shouldn't really get into. Massive generalisations. So what's he done on the pitch? Has it helped Everton? And are Everton a better side with him there dictating play? And I think in most cases they are. Most cases he's the one that's showcasing that bit of quality. It wasn't much quality against Leeds, but there were a couple of moments there that I described. Wasn't much quality against Burnley. He should have set up the winner. There's also a shot that Nick Pope turns around the post from the edge of the box, which would have been an absolutely belting goal. Yeah, I just think the underlying numbers are good. It's just going to be people taking it on themselves to convert those chances, or it falls to, say, a Calvert-Lewin instead of a Sigurdsson. But I don't know. I think maybe he's kind of ebbed and flowed a little bit because of fitness and because of the side and not having a platform. But if you ask me, and I'll ask you the same question. If you ask me, are Everton a better team with James Rodriguez on the side for all his defensive foibles? I would say yes. What would you say?
Undoubtedly, yes. I just think it's compounded by not having Seamus Coleman, a fit Seamus Coleman in the team as well, with his experience of knowing when to, just how to manage on that right side defensively. It is difficult. You know, teams can obviously identify when they've got the ball or in the transition, can identify a lot of space in behind him. And I do feel as if he was perhaps looked more inclined in the early days to track back. But you just don't know whether or not Carlo Ancelotti's looking at it and saying, look, we don't necessarily always want you tracking back. You know, we can, maybe he's got a system, however effective or not, to deal with it with, you know, his three in midfield or his midfielders. Yep. It's not perfect, obviously. And ideally, you do have, you know, your right-sided player doubling up, if you like, or at least, you know, coming back into his own half. But is that where you really want James Rodriguez? I'd say not. So I look forward to reading that properly. And I think that'll be really, really good. And if anything, just, you know, he just needs a goal, I think. And then a bit like Richarlison, and then I think he'll get into a stride more consistently. But that through ball, you're right, was the execution of it was fantastic. It's just such a shame it didn't get us the winner.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So Chelsea's going to be a tough game, isn't it? But, you know, if any game, almost conversely, back with the fans, under the lights, in the winter, we've had a bit of success against Chelsea at Goodison Park. You know, it's tended to be, as Adonis, our producer, was reminding us, you know, it was, for example, a game when Everton won and Ancelotti got the sack in the tunnel. Mm-hmm. We've had big results against them. And I know some of our team who cover Chelsea are, let's say, very aware of Everton's, I wouldn't say it's a voodoo or hoax over them, but we give as good as we get, if not at Stamford Bridge, certainly. Do you think, difficult, but do you think that he'll make many changes? Do you think he will go with a flat back four? More sort of square, it's going to have to be square pegs and round holes, isn't it? With sort of, you know, if Delph isn't fit, we'll hear about that tomorrow. And Kunku seemingly isn't in the equation.
I would almost automatically write Fabian Delph off for...
what, in general?
for Saturday, not in general. Although I'm sure some people would as well. They'd go that far. I just, given his problems with injury, it would be a huge surprise to me if he's able to return from a hamstring complaint in less than a week. That doesn't seem feasible to me. You asked if we could see a move to 4-3-3 or a flat back four of some kind. We should see that. That's what we should see if Ancelotti follows the evidence of the Burnley game. And it doesn't necessarily have to be square pegs in round holes either. I mean, he might want to keep faith with Alex Iwobi, but you've got in Jonjo Kenny and Niels Nkunku, two players that are specialist right back and left backs. So the option is there for Ancelotti. You could also, I guess, you could see a Mason Holgate or a Ben Godfrey play slightly out of position as a fullback. So there are a few options there. They're not great options, it must be said. It's not Luca Dean, but there are a few options. And of course, they're also monitoring Seamus Coleman's fitness as well. He's been training individually, trying to step things up with a view to potentially featuring on Saturday. Let's see if it's a game too far or not. I hope he's back, because I think obviously it'd be a big boost for Everton to have one of their two first choice fullbacks there. You probably look to shore up that midfield as well, instead of having three at the back and firefighting on the edge of your own box. That third man could maybe just clog things up a little bit higher up the pitch, give Chelsea more difficulty in supplying the strikers, and avoiding a situation where you might have, for example, Timo Werner on the left running one-on-one at Alex Iwobi, which is probably the stuff of nightmares right now. from an Everton perspective, it's funny that the Chelsea guys, like you say, aren't quite as confident as you would expect them to be for this one, and that's in part because of Goodison Park and its symbolism. Let's not forget that the last time Everton played Chelsea, Duncan Ferguson was in the dugout and kind of roaring away, beating his chest metaphorically on the sidelines. The crowd was fully behind him. Yes. And Goodison is a really difficult place to play on those days, particularly for opposition sides. We don't quite have that this time, although it's good that fans will be back to some extent. But I'm trying not to be too negative here, and I will try, but I can't promise much. I don't feel like this is a good matchup for Everton, because they've just got so much energy, that Chelsea side. Particularly if they go slightly more fluid up front. And where I think Yerry Mina and Michael Keane excel against a side like Burnley, where the threat is all in front of them, where it's crosses into the box and long diagonals, and they can make use of their own aerial ability, I think against the quicker, trickier, slippier attackers, they may be exposed a little bit for that lack of pace, the lack of recovery option. So again, does Ancelotti maybe go for a Holgate or a Godfrey in the centre? Probably would say let Michael Keane, given,
you know, his, what I think his, that's a really good shout. I think that's a good shout. I think either or and Keane is a good option, because if you play Mina and Keane, I think, and Keane isn't the slowest in the world, but he needs a few yards to get his, you know, to get going, if you like, if that makes sense. I think if you play OC, you're horribly exposed against the pace, as you were saying.
You could be, and again, Chelsea might play Olivier Giroud up front, and that gives Everton an aerial threat. But what I'm saying is that even to the side of him, you can have players like Timo Werner buzzing around, not necessarily staying in those conventional positions, but just kind of playing in space and interchanging. That's a difficult task for Keane and Mina. We saw it exposed against Fulham even when they played in the back three. They weren't able to compensate in transition. So that's an area I'd look at. Mason Mount, another one. N'Golo Kante can drive forward from midfield. So I'd almost be looking to cut them off at source, and I'd be looking to play a quicker centre-back, even if Giroud is likely to start. So, yeah, I think it's a daunting task. Obviously, Chelsea head into the game in fantastic form. They've got, I think now, one of the bonuses for them this season is that they have effectively two starting lineups that they can rotate throughout the campaign. I think this is the season. Yeah. As we've said before, this is the season where you need your squad depth to tell, to pay, and pay dividends, because the games are so quick. I think of Everton, have we got five in 17 days? Well, you can't play, your first 11 cannot play five games in 17 days. That's practically impossible from a physical perspective. So the fact that Chelsea can take off Christian Pulisic and bring on Callum Hudson-Odoi, it kind of is a massive boost for them. So it's a tough game. It's a really tough game. It's not the game you would want, even at Goodison, to get back on track. All Everton can do is stick to what they do well, and that's 4-3-3, getting quick ball out to Richarlison, getting crosses into the box for Calvert-Lewin, making sure that James gets the ball as much as possible in advanced positions, and doing the defensive basics well. You've got Alan and Doucouré hopefully to mop up. Probably if you go three in midfield, you pick Andre Gomes. You probably go for him, don't you, after last weekend. He's there obviously to provide a bit of something on the ball. So this, yeah, it's a tough task. It's going to be a difficult one. The only other thing to add here is how great it is to have some supporters, even if it's only 2,000 or so, under, back at Goodison for this game. It feels like, even just on a local level, that's tangible progress, and it's going to be great. I mean, you're going, aren't you? So I'm sure that's something you must be looking forward to.
Yeah, I am, absolutely. As I say, I like games at Goodison against Chelsea, for better or worse, maybe sometimes. It's always an occasion, and it'll just be a lovely little step back towards semblance of normality to have some fans there. Just look, because it's been so unnatural to be there without fans, as we both said during this year. So yeah, it'll be great. I do think, you know, when you underline the difference in terms of squad depth, drills home the point that Everton haven't got what we hoped they might have in terms of depth for a team that they had aspirations, or have aspirations, of top six, top seven. So we're just going to have to be, I mean, I think Ancelotti's going to have to, you know, sort of be a bit more flexible over the younger players, for example, Kunku and Gordon in games.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just going to have to hope that something special happens on Saturday that really fires the squad and gets them into that mentality of starting games quickly, keeping the ball. You know, you spoke about that at Burnley again. They started a little slowly. In terms of sloppy passing, they need to be on it and to come out of this mini malaise. And sometimes it just seems to happen around this time of year, doesn't it? Whether it was David Moyes, or, you know, hopefully in terms of Ancelotti, with Duncan Ferguson, like you say, they're on the touchline. Let's see. But I'm looking forward to being there. Do you think a European finish? It's very early, reasonably early in the season, so no one's going to say any cut and dry predictions by far just yet. But as we head towards the January window, do you think a European finish is still a realistic prospect?
It is. If they can pick themselves up, it's still, I don't know if I'd use the phrase realistic prospect, but it's still a
target, then I should say.
Yeah, it's still a realistic target. I mean, you look at how saturated the table is this season. Very few points separate kind of second down to mid-table even. And Everton are obviously in that mid-table bunch. If you get one win or two wins, you propel yourself up that table and you come back in the conversation, not only for Europa League positions, but also Champions League positions. Whether Everton are able to do that, to get that consistency without players like Dean, obviously remains to be seen. I've got my concerns heading into this busy run where the squad depth will be tested. It's tough on the face of it. If they can somehow get through to January and they can pick up a few wins here or there and they're still in the conversation, then you never know, because at some point Luca Dean will come back and at some point Ancelotti and Brands will look to the January window and they might have a look and see what they can do. If he's backed, then we know that Ancelotti can make quality improvements to this side. It's realistic at the moment. It's a target at the moment. Are they playing well enough to finish in Europe as it stands? No. Far from it, actually. I think they look like a standard mid-table, lower mid-table side at this moment in time, slugging it out with sides like Burnley, like as we saw on Saturday. And I think Burnley will be in trouble themselves this year, actually. But they're not too far away from, if they get back to the kind of style they were playing earlier this season, the kind of system, maximising the potential of people like Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin. There are some concerted strengths in this side that we have to remember as well. There are games where if you keep things tight, Richarlison, James and Calvert-Lewin will win you matches more or less single-handedly. So I think that's got to be the aim. They've got to shore up that defence. I think Ancelotti's got to look a little bit more to some of the guys on the fringes, Gordon and Kunku. Even potentially just off the bench in Gordon's case, just give him 20 minutes if you're 1-0 down or you're away at a side that you should be beating. Give him 20 minutes to go and see if he can create something. It only takes him to come inside on his right foot and bend one into the top corner and he's won you the game then, hasn't he? And just in that very quick...
Absolutely.
That's what I hope to see. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, talking about all these games against Chelsea, you've got Ancelotti getting sacked. I think it was after Jermaine Beckford scored that amazing solo goal where he just kept on running and running and running. Ancelotti gets sacked after that game. Everton obviously won. 1-0, I think it was. We've spoken about the Duncan Ferguson match, which was a Herculean effort from him and from the players. I was thinking, before we started recording, of Lukaku scoring twice in FA Cup quarter-final. That was a night game at Goodison. I think it was a 5:30, and the atmosphere was just absolutely electric. Obviously, Rom was fantastic. So there are notable games against Chelsea. But one of the other games I wanted to bring up with you, given that you've written a piece on this guy over the course of this week on the site, is the match Everton played against Chelsea in which Dennis Strakwalasi scored the goal and then kind of, I think he sunk to his knees, didn't he, after beating Petacek, maybe in a bit of surprise that he'd beaten Petacek. Before we maybe go on to discuss that game and some of his memorable moments, what are your memories of him?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Yeah, Strack Attack. My memories of trying to Google his name and sitting there at my laptop in the local paper at the time and just trying to get how to spell that name into my head once I'd figured out who he was. He certainly wasn't one that was on many people in Europe's radar. Classic bit of David Moyes business, I think. Late in the market. It was always late in the market, wasn't it? Always a touch of desperation about it. Could never get probably any of the targets he wanted. We'd lost Ikubu and Beckford, who'd obviously scored the goal against Chelsea that you talk about there, the preceding last day of the season. And we just needed extra firepower. You know, he was never going to be sort of necessarily the main man, but we certainly needed extra firepower. And there'd been attempts by people representing him to try and get him into Everton earlier in that summer. Everton weren't interested. Robbie Cook, Tony Henry, the chief scout at the time, just knocked back the agent. And then it got to the last day, and lo and behold, Everton demurred, and he was an Everton player, albeit on loan. He was just one of those players. He didn't look in any way a player sometimes, but I've seen, you know, some players though, just by virtue of the personality, the way they engage with fans, and with him, that, but then sheer determination and effort and perspiration and commitment to the shirt, they can win sections of fans over, for better or worse, because I know a lot of people say, well, you know, you should demand more than that. You know, it should be a given. Yeah, but there's work rate and there's work rate. He did not stop grafting every minute.
It was force of will, really, wasn't it? I think it was force of will. He didn't always have the kind of the technical abilities, but
yeah,
he proved to the supporters very early on that it meant something to be at Everton Football Club, that he was going to give his all. I mean, for some sets of supporters, they might look and raise an eyebrow when players fall to the turf and start crying after they've scored their first goal, like Strachwellersi did against Fulham, if I remember
right. That's right, in the FA Cup.
But for Everton fans, I think there was a sense of connection there. And he did score some important goals, and he did lead the line well at times. And like I say, I think that was force of will as much as anything. Cast your mind back to that window, though, the final day of the window, though, and Everton lost Arteta. And they lost Ikubu earlier, and they lost Beckford, as you say. And they bring in Denis Strachwellersi, who none of us had heard of, and also Royston Drenter on loan. I just remember thinking, what on earth have they done here? They've completely messed this up. But they hadn't, had they? They went on in the end to have a pretty good season, not a fantastic season, but they went on to have kind of a pretty good season around the same kind of finish that they would normally have. Strachwellersi obviously endeared himself to supporters, Drenter less so, and particularly not to David Moyes. But you, for the piece, you spoke to a lot of people that played with Strachwellersi, a lot of people that were close to him during his time on Merseyside. What kind of things were they saying?
There was just universal goodwill towards him. You know, there was just this attitude that he had, that to make the most of the opportunity he'd been given. And, you know, by hook or by crook, even really when he had no right to sort of be there, in terms of a technical ability, I suppose, he had the right to be there, of course, but, you know, sharing a pitch with, you know, some of the players at the time, like Pienaar and Heitinger, who would go on to World Cup finals. And he just seemed to be deliriously happy to be at Everton and to be playing football for the Blues. And I think that translates. And, you know, when he was in the team, he did some things well in terms of one of the coaches I spoke to was talking about how, by virtue of his sheer effort leading the line, it would create space and opportunities for others. He would chase anything and everything all day. And sometimes someone like that, even if they're not the best technically, just a pain for defenders. And then I'd remember that goal, as you say, you know, he kind of, the Chelsea goal, it's a terrific challenge by Phil Neville, by the way. If you go on YouTube and look at that, you know, Phil Neville even had his detractors at Everton, and, you know, people talk about Strachwellersi not being the best technically. It was something, albeit a different, in a different sense, levelled at Neville at times, but goodness me, he could change a game sometimes. And he puts in this amazing tackle on Ashley Cole, which would probably be a straight red now. The ball breaks and Everton launched this counter-attack. Landon Donovan, who was flying at the time, slips in a little through ball between two defenders, and there's the strike, and he hits it with his right foot, and it's not the cleanest hit, but it must have had some strength on it, because even Peter Cech, you know, sort of renowned, strong command and presence, gets a hand to it but can't keep it out. And it's as if Strachwellersi is watching it for a split second, see it's gone in, and then he just runs, and he's just ecstatic in front of the Gladys Street. I think a lot of his goals, maybe even all of his goals, were in front, well, all three, were in front of the Gladys Street. And that always helps for a striker, doesn't it, at Everton? And David Moyes on the touchline, jumping up and down. And, you know, you can't forget what result that was, really, in many ways. I mean, Chelsea would go on to be the FA Cup winners that season, which is brilliant, against Liverpool. they'd win the Champions League that season, bizarrely, in different circumstances, of course. They'd finished only just above us, actually, sixth, albeit a few more points. There were 64. We ended up finishing seventh on 56. But wouldn't you take that this season if we could somehow conjure another, maybe not as against the odds, but another sort of morale-boosting win on Saturday?
Yeah, well, I just think that once everybody is fit in this Everton side and you have Luca Dean at left-back and Seamus Coleman at right-back, a settled central defensive partnership, Alan and Doucouré in the middle, Richarlison, Calvert-Lewin, James up front, I still think that's not far away from being a side that can compete at that level. The problem is what happens if one of the key men, and at the moment that's Luca Dean, picks up a big injury and is out for any length of time. It's there where the squad depth pays, like we're saying, and they're in a little bit of a rut right now. Maybe things aren't quite going the way. What happens if, for example, Doucouré scores early on against Leeds or Sigurdsson scores late on against Burnley? Maybe the tide just changes slightly, and sometimes it only takes one game, one win. Last season, I think that game, even though it wasn't a great season by any stretch of the imagination, last season was in a really dodgy place until that win for Ferguson against Chelsea in December, around the same time of the year, actually, in a curious sense. And Everton are not quite in that position now, but they need something. So it might only take one. It might only take one game for this side to just pick up and just get that bit of form and just kind of crank up a gear or two, like we know they are capable of doing. So yeah, fingers crossed. I'll be envious of your seat in the main stand press box while you cover that one on Saturday, and here's to hopefully to 3 points.
Yeah, let's hope so. Well, thank you very much for that, Pad, and thank you to you for listening. Don't forget, you can subscribe to Athletic and give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any of your football fan family or friends. Just go, you know where to go, theathletic.com/EvertonPod. We will be back next week. In the meantime, whether it's with the Strack or not, let's hope someone does the business and finds a winner against Chelsea. See you next time.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.